Right now, though, we're going to talk about a new biography. A biography is called Steve McQueen, and we have on the line right now the author of that, Mark Elliott, who joins us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
You've written other biographies of sort of Hollywood icons. What is it that draws you to those people that you're so interested in investigating their life story?
Well, I've always been a student of Hollywood, and I've always looked for those personalities that can really illustrate both the art of film, the business of Hollywood, and those actors who epitomize a certain rebellion and conformity at the same time. The era that I write about a lot, 50s through 80s, 90s, fascinates me. I grew up in those years, and these were heroes of mine. And sometimes, you know, I always thought to write a book hoping to love the person that I write about. And it makes my life easier, and it makes the book better, I think. And in almost every instance, not every time, but almost every time that has happened, what you do in the process is you go backstage and you see how the magician does the trick. And it takes the magic out of seeing it. But somewhere along the line, as everything begins to come together, the magic comes back. And that's essentially what I do, is I break down the trick, look at it, and then put it back for you. So at the end, you can say, wow, this actor was either great or not so great, or now I understand him better, and I'd really like to go back and look at some of those movies. And if that much happens, I feel I did my job, and I've contributed something to the pop culture, especially of America.
So, Mark, what did you conclude then from the life of Steve McQueen?
Well, Steve McQueen was somebody who tried to convince the world he was who he wasn't, and tried to convince himself at the same time that he wasn't who he really was. He looked great. He was a natural for the screen. He had that charismatic way. James Dean had it. Brando had it. Paul Newman certainly had it. But inside, he was a mess. He was born from a mother who met the husband on a one-night stand. The father was a stunt pilot, flew away after about a month. The mother couldn't afford to raise him, so she shunted him off to an uncle. He drifted around. He fell in with street gangs, and eventually he wound up in reform school. So his beginnings really set the stage, or set the scene, for what is to come, which is, you know, like in Citizen Kane, when they try to figure out, well, what was it about him? What drove him? And at the end, you see the thing burning in the sled burning, and it says Rosebud. It means, you say to yourself, ah, it was his mother. Well, with Steve McQueen, it's very much that. He goes through life searching for that lost love. The first wife is an older woman, a star on Broadway, Neal Adams, and she kind of marries him and adopts him at the same time. He's like her beautiful little boy. The second wife was Allie McGraw. She was much less paternal or much less maternal, and didn't go for having a little boy as a husband. And the third wife was much younger and allowed him to reverse roles. He became a father figure, and interestingly enough, at the end of his life, he started learning how to fly stunt planes. So you see, there is an arc running through his life of lost love and attempting to find love. And ironically, on screen, playing characters, the world loved him. In real life, he was much less lovable. But that's Hollywood. That's what Hollywood gives us, is a romanticized version of reality. And we love it because it's romanticized.
On screen, it seemed as though he was in search of adventure in many of his movie roles. And he was a race car driver in real life to a degree, loved riding motorcycles. Did he also have this adventuresome side?
Yeah, he was, the motorcycles were the only place that he could be alone, the only place where he could be fully in control, this mass machinery that he would ride and drive and conquer. That was Steve McQueen. He loved to travel. He loved to go to Alaska, take the family up there, go fishing. What he didn't like was going to Taiwan and Hong Kong for 6 months to make the sand pebbles. That kind of traveling he didn't like. He felt that was an imposition on him, that he was just a worker servicing other people. And that led him eventually to try to form his own production company so he could control the movies that he made and fine-tune the character that he played.
That seems to be where Hollywood is these days anyway, with, you know, the way you look at the way things are produced now. It's an artist who has a company, and then they put their pieces together. When Steve McQueen started out, was he part of the old Hollywood system? Was he one of those that kind of bridged the gap then from the studios to sort of the independent filmmakers?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a product of, first of CBS TV. They cast him in Wanted, Dead or Alive. And then he became... Then he signed a picture deal, I believe, with Paramount, and then one with Columbia. And he was slotted into roles that he didn't necessarily think were the best roles for him. So in those days, if you didn't work with the studios, you didn't work because there was no real independent movement. That came in the 70s after Easy Rider when, they used to say, the inmates took over the asylum. Steve was a rebel, and when he finally did form his own company, he made some very bad choices, partly because he was concerned with whether or not he was a really good actor. He knew he was a presence. He wanted to be a method actor like Brando. And his rival, his self-described rival, Paul Newman, was had it all together effortlessly. Newman had that smile and that charm, and mystified Steve McQueen. He couldn't quite understand how Newman was able to pull that off. And, you know, it bothered him his whole life.
Were they friends, rivals? Did they show up at the casting at the same roles? I know they appeared in several films together. How did those things happen and go?
They appeared in two films together. The first was Somebody Up There Likes Me, where Paul Newman played Rocky Graziano's life story, taken from a very popular memoir. Now, he had auditioned for that, Paul Newman, and lost out to James Dean. James Dean was then killed in that car crash. They went back to Paul Newman. Bob Wise, who directed the film, had to cast kids around the Paul Newman character when he was a street kid. One of them was Sal Mineo, who... that film made a star. And another one was Steve McQueen, who had a smaller part. Steve McQueen believed that he was a better actor than Paul Newman and that he was going to one day outdo him. Now, you skip ahead about 10 years, and 20th Century Fox buys a script from William Goldman about two outlaws called Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And they pay $200,000 to Bill Goldman under the assumption that they're going to have Steve McQueen and Paul Newman. Paul Newman at the time was going to play the Sundance Kid. The only problem was when they brought it to Steve, he said he wanted first position, which means top billing on screen, because he felt he was a bigger star by now than Paul Newman. And in fact, he was. His films were more popular than Paul Newman's. Newman had a tendency to make smaller, edgier films that didn't make as much money as Steve McQueen's. Newman refused to give up the first position. This went on for months, and finally at a meeting at Fox, Steve just got up, threw his hands up, and said, "That's it," walked out, quit the project. They then tried to get Warren Beatty to play the role. Beatty said no, there weren't enough women in the film. And they finally found Robert Redford. But to get Redford, Newman said, "I'm going to play Butch Cassidy." So the film was originally called The Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy. Because Steve left, it became Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid. And, of course, it made Paul Newman a superstar. It put Robert Redford on the map, and Steve was out. Go ahead 10 years later, and they're making... The Towering Inferno. This time, Paul is less virulent in his insistence on first position. So he makes a deal saying, in the States, his name will come second but higher on the screen. Overseas, it'll be his name first and Steve McQueen's name higher. Still not good enough for Steve. Steve says, I need to have the exact same amount of words as Paul Newman. Not lines, words. And I have to have the last line of the film. So when you watch The Towering Inferno, it's really fun, not to count lines, obviously, but to see the balance of these two characters that don't really make too much sense together. The film was taken from two different novels and kind of sewn together. But at the end, when it appears the film is over, Steve comes along and has one final line, and that's the end of the film. And to him, that was the conquest. That was how he finally became a bigger star than Paul Newman.
Well, we look back at that. I mean, we're chuckling when you're telling this story, and I'm thinking, you know, whoever pays attention to that, I guess, other than the artist, but that's maybe something within them that they're so competitive or they're particular about or they're in some mood. Because for the audience, to me, it would make no difference, you know.
It makes no difference to the audience, but to the actors, it means money. First position or top billing is a money slot. That's why credits are so important in film. Who comes first, who comes second, the producer, the screenwriter, all of that is very carefully worked out, because when you go to make another movie, what they base your salary on, their offer, is what position you are, because that tells them who carried the film. And, of course, on the other side, if the film bombs, they usually blame the actor, not whatever else went on. So for Newman and Steve McQueen, it was a question of ego, without doubt, but also a money situation, because it meant that one of them was a bigger star and could go on and make more money to the audience and for his next movie. The audience doesn't care, and most of the time the audience doesn't even look at the credits or where the position of the credits are. They're listening to the music, or they're watching what's behind the credits. So it's an industry thing. But for Steve McQueen, it became a personal battle, like so much of what went on in his life was.
We're talking today with Mark Elliott, the author of Steve McQueen, A Biography. You mentioned a little bit about bombs. I don't consider it a bomb, but his career kind of goes up and down. And I remember the day that I discovered that Steve McQueen was in The Blob. You know, I'd seen The Great Escape and The Towering Inferno, and then all of a sudden some afternoon you're thinking, wait a minute, that's Steve McQueen. What's he doing in this Saturday afternoon monster movie that I'm watching? How did that all come about?
Well, that came about because there was an independent producer who owned the rights to this crazy science fiction story about the blob coming to Earth. And Steve needed money. He wasn't yet a big star. He wanted to be in the movies. But I'll tell you the interesting thing about that is that the producer said to him, look, I'll give you $3,000 to be in this film, or I'll give you 5% of the back end. Now, Steve went to his manager, Hilly Elkins, and said, what should I do? And Hilly said, well, no one's going to ever see this film. It probably won't even open. Take the $3,000 and run. And, of course, we know that the film went on to gross almost $20 million in the 50s, which today would be about $100 million. And so wrong decision and a film that came back to haunt him because it is not the Steve McQueen that we all remember. But I'll tell you, I saw it recently. Not that bad a movie.
Sure, and I think there's a little kish or cult credibility that gets if you show up. Because, you know, you got Jack Nicholson showing up in Little Shop of Horrors. You have those kind of things. So it's maybe something nice to have on the resume saying, hey, I'm cool enough to have done something like that.
And in those days, you know, with films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Psycho coming a little bit after, there was a certain panache to horror sci-fi that before it became George Lucas and Steve Spielberg, horror sci-fi. These are offbeat films, usually the bottom of the bill. And because they were the bottom of the bill, the second feature, there was a little more freedom. You could do a little bit more. And The Blob, you know, is such a preposterous movie, and yet it's a lot of fun to watch. And Steve is very good in it. He plays a kind of a tough kid who leads the teenagers, doesn't need the police's help, gets stuck in a supermarket, and it's kind of fun to watch with the blob, stuck with the blob in the supermarket.
Steve McQueen passed away in 1980 of cancer at just 50 years old. You mentioned how he, sort of Paul Newman is a rival, similar person. Yeah. We saw what Paul Newman did in his later years. After having written this biography, what would you have projected for Steve McQueen? Would he have done Clint Eastwood type of things, have been a director and kind of starred in things? Where do you see him?
Well, in his last film, I think it was Tom Horn, he actually wanted to take over directing. The director was fired. But union rules, Directors Guild rules, forbid anybody who is connected with a film taking over if a director is fired. It's just one of the regulations. So he couldn't do it. But that was undoubtedly the direction he was headed. And, you know, when you compare, as I do in the book, I compare McQueen and Eastwood. Eastwood's career didn't really begin its second more important phase until after he was 50 years old. If Eastwood had died at 50, he would be remembered today as The Man with No Name and Dirty Harry. Good movies, good career, but when you think about what happened after, from 50 to 80, because he's the same exact age as Steve McQueen, all the Academy Awards and the brilliant directing that he did, all of that came after the age of 50. So Steve McQueen's career of 28 movies barely gets him into the Pantheon. I mean, he just makes it in. And we remember him because the great movies he made are so memorable. The Great Escape, Bullet, the Magnificent Seven, so many of those films that just stay in your mind. The Sand Pebbles, my personal favorite, and
That one took me a while to watch because they always had the theme from the Sand Pebbles, and that particular song. I thought, what kind of a movie is this that has that love song in it that they would sing? But I finally did see it, and I realized how it was a. You know, there's a military movie. It's not just a love story, as it were. So
it's a military movie, and it had overtones of Vietnam. And it turned Steve, for one of the few times in his career, into a political Steve McQueen. And he started giving interviews about America's involvement in Vietnam. And the next minute, the FBI was investigating him. And he quickly lost that, dropped that. And moved back into a more apolitical stance. But it did hurt him a little bit because if you think back in those days during Vietnam, anybody who took a position lost half of its audience. And I think it hurt him, and I think it hurt that film. I happen to think it's a brilliant movie and beautifully acted and one of his best and most evenly sustained performances. It hasn't been seen a lot lately, but it pops up occasionally on things like Turner Classic Movies. And if you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth a look. It's a beautiful and unusual film.
We're talking today with Mark Elliott. Steve McQueen, a biography is what he has written. Thanks for sharing the information. You've got the book, the details on it, and kind of maybe a new generation of folks can discover Steve McQueen.
Oh, that would be great. It's good talking to you.